Mitt navn Erlend Fischer. Jeg jobber som klimarådgiver i Naturvernforbundet. Takk for at dere kom til denne parallellsesjonen i dag, som heter «Hvordan bygge broer, kommunikasjon og organisering i det grønne skiftet». Og noen vil kanskje lure på hvorfor vi har satt sammen kommunikasjon og organisering. Og det vil jeg si innledningsvis at det er veldig viktig vi snakker om hvordan vi snakker om klima. Vi vil øke bevissthet blant medier og blant folket. Men broen til fremtiden handler også om hvordan vi skaper engasjement for noen ganske klare krav og skaper en debatt rundt en rettferdig omstilling, 100.000 klimajobber og hva Norge skal leve av etter oljen. Og disse er veldig vanskelige og kompliserte temaer. Og det er også sånn vi vil at folk skal bry seg, men også at de skal gjøre noe, og at de skal handle i fellesskap. Som mange av dere som har sikkert... Lei av dette hvis du er sånn kommunikasjonsstudent eller jobber som kommunikasjonsdirektør i Cicero, for eksempel, så betyr det latinske ordet som kommunisere kommer fra å gjøre felles eller å dele, kommunikare på latinsk. Derfor er det også viktig at vi tenker på hvordan vi holder engasjement oppe og dyrker engasjement gjennom å bygge bevegelse. Dette har alltid vært sånne sentrale oppgaver for fagbevegelsen, for kirken og miljøorganisasjoner som står bak broen til fremtiden. Men vi kan alltid bli bedre. Og når vi ser folkelig mobilisering rundt klima, som barna og ungdommene som streiker i dag, hvordan kan vi få flere med på laget? Hvordan kan vi spesielt nå de som vi ikke enda har nådd ut til, inkludert de som er avhengige av fossile ressurser, når det gjelder jobber eller lokale samfunn? Og hvordan kan vi gjøre det grønne skiftet felles? I dag skal vi nok ikke frem til det endelige svaret, men vi skal i hvert fall begynne en diskusjon. Og det skal være plass til diskusjon, også spørsmål og kommentarer fra salen i denne bolken her. Men først har vi tre innledere som vil gi oss et utmerket utgangspunkt for en slik diskusjon. Og for å begynne har vi Christian Bjørnes fra Cicero. Han er kommunikasjonsdirektør. Etter det skal vi høre fra Samantha Smith, som jobber i Just Transition Center, som var en global satsing av det internasjonale fagforening, internasjonale hovedsammenslutning ITUC, om en rettferdig omstilling. Og så skal vi høre fra Skype fra en som heter Job van der Assem, som jobber i Friends of the Earth Nederland, som er Naturvernforbundets siste organisasjon i Nederland, som skal snakke om hvordan de jobber med klima i Nederland, og hvordan de organiserer folk rundt klima. Men for å begynne med, Christian. Vær så god.
Takk for introduksjonen, og takk for at jeg ble invitert hit for å snakke. Det er jo litt spesielt da, å snakke om klimakommunikasjon og det å lage engasjement på en dag som denne, hvor det står som tusenvis av skoleungdom superengasjerte foran Stortinget og roper opp om at de voksne må ta mer ansvar. Det er rett og slett veldig, veldig rørende. Skal vi se, har jeg noe sånn klikker?
Ja, det har jeg.
Fordi da jeg begynte i Cicero i 2007, og da var vi veldig... jeg opplevde at folk var liksom høflig interessert i det vi hadde å si, men det var ikke det engasjementet som vi ser nå, bortsett kanskje fra noen få som var veldig engasjert, som vi kaller for klimaskeptikere. Og på den tiden så brukte vi masse tid på å justere hvordan vi skulle omtale usikkerhet, hvordan vi skulle imøtegå klimaskeptikere i obskure tidsskrifter. Og sånn som det skaper rett og slett ikke noe engasjement hos folk. Det innså vi ganske fort. Mange av oss som jobber med klimakommunikasjon har liksom falt inn i det her fordi vi er opptatt av klima, og ikke fordi at vi nødvendigvis kan så innmari mye om kommunikasjon. Og da jeg fikk en ny kollega ved Cicero, som heter Astrid, og hun har... en grad i markedsføring, og så minnet hun meg på at Christian, dere jobber først og fremst med kommunikasjon. De helt vanlige reglene for formidling og kommunikasjon gjelder like mye for Cicero som for alle andre. Og husk at Cicero og klimasaken, den konkurrerer med, om oppmerksomheten med folk som Røde Kors, for eksempel, hvor hun jobbet før, med spillselskaper som vil ha deg til å gamble bort pengene dine, med turoperatører som vil ha deg til å reise på ferie, og Facebook som vil ha deg til å bruke mest mulig tid online, sånn at annonsørene deres må betale mest mulig penger. Altså, vi måtte bli litt proffere. Så da vi skulle oppdatere rapporten vår om klimakommunikasjon, som der hvor vi samler våre erfaringer og det vi ser viktig, og best practices og sånne ting, så var det viktig for oss at vi denne gangen også tok en prat med folk som jobber i kommunikasjonsbyråer, altså kommunikasjonseksperter, som jobber for disse store merkevarene, og som kan fortelle oss hvilke triks og knep de bruker i sin hverdag, sånn at vi kan bruke dem til å skape mer engasjement om klima. Så det var utgangspunktet for den rapporten som jeg skal snakke om i dag. Og basert på dette, og basert selvfølgelig på det vi har lest om klimaforskning, om forskning på klimakommunikasjon, så har vi destillert 5 som konkrete råd, og de skal jeg gjennomgå. Rapporten heter Effektiv klimakommunikasjon, trender og fakta 2018. Og hvorfor er kommunikasjon så viktig? Det jo fordi at vi vet veldig mye om hvilke utfordringer vi står overfor. Vi vet hva vi skal gjøre, men vi må få med oss folk. Vi må få med oss folk på de vanskelige endringene som skal skje, og det er en utrolig vrien oppgave. Og det er det. Kommunikasjon kan spille en stor og viktig rolle i å skape rom for ambisiøs klimapolitikk og skape aksept for at man av og til må innføre tiltak som gjør litt grann vondt. Men der utfordringene er jo også hvordan i all verden skal vi skape engasjement rundt klimasaken. Og der vil jeg si at det er så utrolig fint at en 15 år gammel svensk jente som Greta Thunberg, hun viser at hvis du treffer riktig, så er det mulig. Altså, ett menneske, tenk på det dere, ett menneske har klart å få skoleungdom over hele verden til å gå ut i streik og til å si tydelig fra. Ett menneske har skapt enormt med engasjement. Det er ganske utrolig. For oss, det første av de 5 rådene, det er å gjøre det lokalt. Å snakke om det som er nært. Og folk er gjerne med på å løse problemer. Folk er gjerne med på å skape engasjement. Men det bør ta utgangspunkt i noe som er nært, og noe som folk føler en tilknytning til. Og ifølge de ekspertene vi har snakket med, så er det helt meningsløst å prøve å få folk til å være engasjert i noe de ikke synes er relevant, synes er nært, tangerer hverdagen deres på en eller annen fornuftig måte. Sånn at hvis man skal ha du skal bruke, lage engasjement gjennom lokale aksjoner, gjennom lokale problemløsninger, så må du rett og slett være villig til å lete blant det målgruppa synes er interessant, og ikke kanskje blant det du synes er aller mest interessant. Og så kan man heller pense folk inn på klimaendringer og adferdsendringer litt etter hvert. Og det er noe de har gjort. Dette er et bilde som vi har fått låne av 1010, som er en brittisk kampanjeorganisasjon, som jobber veldig mye med hvordan man kan utløse lokalt engasjement. Og her har de hatt et prosjekt hvor de har installert solceller på taket på en lokal skole. Fordi ifølge 1010 så er det mye viktigere for folk å snakke om inneklima, om hvordan skolen kan spare penger, sånn at de kan bruke mer på undervisning, etc. når du får folk liksom investert i det og engasjementet om det, så begynner de å snakke om klimaendringer og hvorfor fornybar energi også en viktig bro til fremtiden. På et annet bilde som ofte engasjerer, det i stedet for å snakke om at folk ikke burde kjøre så mye bil, så skal man heller kanskje snakke om hva redusert biltrafikk fører til, nemlig mye tryggere skoleveier. Og dette bildet jo også noe av det mest brukte i lokalaviser. En organisasjon som virkelig har tatt dette her på alvor, de heter Bærekraftige Liv. Det noen fra den organisasjonen her i dag? Som har tatt turen fra Bergen, fra Landås? Ja. Det i 2008 så satte en gruppe damer seg ned på Landås i Bergen og lurte på hvordan de kunne redde verden. Og så fant de ut at egentlig så bor alle verdens problemer på Landås, og alle verdens løsninger bor også på Landås. Man må ta utgangspunkt i det lokale. Og så gikk de rundt og spurte nabolaget sitt, hva det dere trenger, hva det dere vil ha, hvordan kan vi gjøre Landås til et bedre sted å være? Og utifra det så har det vokst en bevegelse som heter Bærekraftige Liv, og som har spredt seg også til andre deler av Norge. Så det råd nummer to, og det folk liker å være med på det andre med på. Det har vi også forskning som støtter ganske tydelig, hvor vi ser at engasjement rundt klimaendringer, villighet til å gjøre ting, det øker betraktelig dersom du samtidig får beskjed om at andre gjør det samme. Dette er jo noe som i dag også, hvor man ser engasjementet som Greta Thunberg har skapt, hvordan det smitter og får andre involvert. Og jeg sikker på at hvis dere tar opp Instagram eller Twitter eller et eller annet sosialt medium akkurat nå, så kommer det til å være et stort engasjement rundt skolestreiker, og folk tar bilder av hverandre og poster i sosiale medier. Hvis man ser litt utenfor klima- og miljøfeltet, så Movember en kampanje som har satt søkelys på menns helse, og som startet som en liten idé blant to karer i Australia, men som har spredt seg til en verdensomspennende kampanje. Og sosiale medier gjør det mulig å vise fram at man engasjert og at man tar ansvar, og det har også en verdi. Hold Norge rent satte dette her i system med strandryddedagen, hvor de fikk, folk har ryddet strender lenge, men de skjønte at okay, hvis vi får folk til å gjøre det på samme dag, så møter de hverandre, og hvis vi får folk til å poste dette her i sosiale medier, så synes de, og dette her var jo med på å bygge og gjøre det engasjementet mye sterkere. Sånn at nå så har begrepet strandryddedag liksom blitt helt dagligdags, og noe statsministeren selvfølgelig med på. Hvis du spør unge i dag, eller ekspertene peker også på at unge i dag jo ikke med på hva som helst i sosiale medier heller. De interessert i å sammenligne seg med andre, og ditt budskap må passe inn i deres strategi. Det ikke sånn at de bare tomme kanaler for dine budskap, men de opptatt av å bygge en merkevare og en tilstedeværelse i sosiale medier. Så det må man liksom ta høyde for det også. Og så kan man dele felles opplevelser med folk over hele verden. Dette her et bilde av The Ice Bucket Challenge, som var en sånn farsott som gikk på internett, hvor man skulle kaste en bøtte med isvann over hodet, opprinnelig til inntekt for ALS-saken, en ganske alvorlig sykdom, men etter hvert så glemte folk helt bort det, og det forsvant. Så man må passe på budskapet sitt også når man drar i gang sånne sosiale medierkampanjer. Så til dette med å tilpasse budskapet til mottakeren. Dette på mange måter ikke noe nytt. Det en bok som kom ut for noen år siden som heter PR, The Social History of Spin, og forteller historien om hvordan den store depresjonen i USA, store monopoler og elendige arbeidsforhold gjorde amerikanerne rett og slett skeptiske til kapitalismen som system. Og svaret fra industrien, det var jo ikke en massiv informasjonskampanje om hvor fortryllende kapitalismen var. Men de laget en kampanje som koblet kapitalisme og næringsliv, fritt næringsliv, til amerikanske kjerneverdier som frihet og fremskritt. Og man fikk liksom slagordet «There's no way like the American way». Man fikk dette her inn i TV-serier, man fikk det inn i Hollywood-filmer, man fikk dette budskapet inn veldig mange steder, og man må jo si at de lyktes med den jobben. Fordi kapitalismen jo relativt populær i Amerika fremdeles. Og så får man noen sånn pussige utslag av dette her med når folk investert med verdiene sine, og hvordan folk overbevist. Dette her, dere husker kanskje dette bildet, det tatt under innsettelsen til Trump, til høyre, og så det Obama til venstre. Og YouGov gjorde en undersøkelse hvor de spurte Trump-velgere og Clinton-velgere, hvor det flest mennesker? Og de aller, aller fleste svarte jo riktig, det flest mennesker på det bildet til venstre. Men hele 15% av Trump-velgerne svarte at det flest mennesker på bildet til høyre. Og det jo ganske utrolig. For det de jo ikke. Men allikevel så mente de det. Og hvordan kunne de i all verden, hvordan i all verden går det an å få seg til å si noe sånt? Det viser jo at følelser og verdensanskuelse og hva du tenker om deg selv, hvem du og så videre, det ekstremt effektivt i å stoppe fakta. Fordi hvis et faktum som dette her ville være, det ville være å innrømme at Obama var en langt mer populær person enn det Trump var. Og den innrømmelsen, den gjør noe med hvem du hvem du heier på, hvilke lag du står på. Så i stedet for å si at ja, det var flere mennesker på Obama, jeg tok feil, så sier man heller nei, det var flere mennesker på Trump, jeg har fremdeles rett. Sånn at hvis du blir konfrontert med et faktum som gjør at du må revurdere hvem du og hva du står for, så er det mye enklere å avfeie det som feil heller enn verdiene dine som feil. Det vi også ser jo at folk som klimaskeptiske, de blir ofte mer skeptiske dersom vi gir dem mer kunnskap om klimaendringer, som også helt absurd, men sånn fungerer polariseringen. Det ikke sånn at bare man kommer ut med den riktige kunnskapen, så endrer folk oppfatninger. Men det går an å jobbe med folks verdier på en konstruktiv måte også. Hvis man ser øverst til høyre der, så har vi gruppert en del verdier som vi mener nyttig å ta utgangspunkt i når man skal snakke om klimaendringer, miljøsak og så videre. Mens de verdiene som nederst til venstre verdier som man skal prøve å unngå. Og det ikke sånn at bare noen få av oss har de verdiene opp til høyre hjørne. Alle har liksom vennskap, ærlighet og så videre. Alle har de verdiene. Så det her går liksom på tvers av politisk ståsted og så videre. Så det valg av talsperson. Hvem det som fronter budskapet ditt? Og Greta har vist seg å være en ekstremt effektiv talsperson som fungerer godt overfor veldig mange. Men det vi vet at ulike målgrupper, de tror på ulike talspersoner. Og da gjelder det å finne de talspersonene som gir gjenklang og som målgruppen kan identifisere seg med, og som de føler at ligner på dem selv. Det kan være folk som har opplevd noe lignende, eller lokale ledere, lokale helter og så videre. Det er ikke sånn at man trenger å gå ut og lete etter en kjendis nødvendigvis. For eksempel så har Paul André Grinderud en enorm troverdighet og en enorm evne til å røre folk som talsperson for alkoholikere, fordi han har opplevd det selv. Og Silje Sandmæl er en ekstremt god talsperson for privatøkonomi, rett og slett, fordi hun har liksom ekspertkompetansen på det. En annet menneske som er en god talsperson for gjenbruk har blitt det, er jo Jenny Skavlan, som ble først kjent i Grandiosa-reklamen, men som har bygget seg opp en troverdighet og en følgerskare på Instagram gjennom å fronte gjenbruk og redusert forbruk. Men noen ganger så kan det også gå ordentlig gærent, sånn som her da Pepsi forsøkte å rekruttere en kjendis til en reklamekampanje. Hun heter Kendall Jenner, og reklamefilmen gikk omtrent som følger. Kendall Jenner sitter og sminker seg til et fotoopptak. Hun ser en gruppe ungdommer marsjere forbi. Hun blir med dem i stedet for. De kommer i bråk med politiet. Hun gir politimannen en Pepsi. Alt ordner seg. Problemet er at dette var en demonstrasjon som så ut som det var unge, svarte amerikaneres opprør. Og der har ikke hun noen troverdighet i det hele tatt. Og det ble et storm mot Pepsi, og de måtte stenge hele kampanjen etter et par dager. Så vær forsiktig med hvem dere bruker. Og også i USA så er det en gruppe veteraner som reiser rundt og holder foredrag om fornybar energi. De har med republikanere som målgruppe fordi de har veldig høy troverdighet. Så da fant jo folk i oljebransjen ut at ja, men vi kan jo også bruke veteraner. Så nå er det en gruppe veteraner som reiser rundt og snakker om fornybar, en annen gruppe veteraner som reiser rundt og snakker om økt kull. Så vær også oppmerksom på at talspersonene dine kanskje må være litt eksklusive. Så er det dette her som heter fra handling til holdning, og her har vi ikke så mye forskning, men vi har en del anekdotiske bevis, som for eksempel at da det ble slutt på å røyke i fly, så sluttet folk også å røyke i bilen sin. Det skjedde likhet på. Og da vi ikke kunne røyke på restaurant lenger, så begynte folk å slutte å røyke innendørs. Det vi også ser er at elbilister, de rapporterer i hvert fall selv at de blir mer miljøbevisste etter at de har kjøpt seg en elbil. Og vi vet fra Stockholm at der fikk innbyggerne lov til å prøve rushtidsavgift i et par år, og endte opp med å stemme for permanent innføring av rushtidsavgift i en folkeavstemning etter at de hadde fått prøve det. Men ikke alt trenger å komme som forbud eller påbud heller. Det går an å få folk til å delta på ting, og at de gjennom det endrer holdninger. For eksempel Strandryddedagen eller plogging, som også da var en distanse på Oslo Maraton, 10 kilometer plogging i fjor. Og det sier noe om hvor raskt samfunnet klarer å absorbere sånne trender og måtte allmenngjøre dem. Og igjen så ga dette her folk en mulighet til å skryte litt av seg selv i sosiale medier. Hvis dere ønsker et lite smakebit av dette, så finner dere rapporten vår på Cicero sine nettsider, cicero.oslo.no. Dere trenger ikke å notere ned hele URL-en, den finner dere ved å søke. Og der finner dere både oppsummeringen av ekspertintervjuene og av sammendrag av forskning, og disse fem rådene. Så det var det jeg hadde forberedt, og så kommer vi vel kanskje tilbake igjen med spørsmål og svar etterpå. Takk for meg.
Tusen takk, Christian. Neste innleder er Samantha Smith. Hvor er du, Samantha? Der er du. Kjempebra. Skal du holde tale på engelsk eller på norsk? Samantha skal holde tale på engelsk. Håper det ikke er et problem for dere. Dere har hørt nok bekunnt norsk fra meg allerede. Samantha Smith sitter på LO i Oslo og jobber i det som heter Just Transition Center, en internasjonal satsing av ITUC, som er verdens LO eller IS-union, som ble opprettet etter Parisavtalen i 2015-2016 for å jobbe med rettferdig omstilling i hele verden. Og Samantha kan si litt mer om det, men det betyr hun jobber med broen til framtiden over hele verden. Vær så god, Samantha. Yes.
Thank you very much, Alan. So, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for sticking around and listening to us talk about communication. First of all, I, like Christian, I would just like to recognize that today is a special day. We did have a strike of school children. The right to strike is a fundamental right of workers. And striking has been a part of freedom struggles all over the world. It's a part of our history. And the role of children in protests and struggle movements is also a fundamental part of our history. So I want to recognize the school strikers, recognize their right to strike, their right to freedom of conscience. These are all rights that are important to workers, whether or not we like the cause for which people are striking. And these fundamental rights of freedom of expression and association are under threat all over the world. They're also under threat here in Norway, and we must also recognize that and recognize this discussion we're having in that particular context. So I want to situate myself. Aud gave a brief introduction of who I am. Indeed, I work for the Just Transition Center, which was started by ITUC and the European Trade Union Confederation about 2.5 years ago. And we do a very specific thing. So we support our affiliates and their members in getting concrete agreements on what is called just transition, which in Norwegian is rettferdig omstilling. And a concrete agreement can be a collective bargaining agreement. It can be a law or a piece of legislation. It can be a policy from a government, or it can just be about building enough power with alliances between workers and other groups in society so that you are able to get a proper transition. The second thing I want to say about just transition is that we often think about transition only in the context of things that are going to be phased out or that might have to end because they're high emitting, and we live in a time where we know that we have to bring down CO2 and other climate polluting emissions. But actually, just transition is about two things. So it is about all of the things that need to happen so that workers and communities can feel secure in a transition, can have good jobs after the transition. Older workers can get a bridge to pension, have a dignified old age. Younger workers can get retrained. But it is at least as much about the fight to make sure that new jobs are good jobs. Because one of the things we see overall in the world of work is that our conditions of work are getting worse. They are under attack by governments and employers. And so when new jobs, for example, in renewable energy are created, they are not necessarily with secure contracts, with decent pay, with health and safety in the workplace, with skills training, and in countries like the United States, with health care and pension. So these two things are equally important, and maybe the part about the new jobs and being sure that they are good jobs, that they are based on social protection, the system of social welfare that we enjoy here in Norway, those two things are really equally important. So, like Kristen, I'm also not a communications professional, but I do have one piece of communications advice for those of you who are not in the union movement, and that is you need to show people, not tell them. So I'm not going to tell you a bunch of things about unions and how to communicate with them, but I will tell you about some of our experiences working with unions, and up until now, we're working mostly with what I would call frontline unions, industrial workers, so mining unions, power sector and energy unions, oil and gas, auto, steel, other manufacturing unions. I do have one other piece of advice, actually, and this is for people who don't come from the union movement, and that is that for unions, conflict is not always bad, right? You're talking about a movement that makes a point by walking out, refusing labor, by having massive protest demonstrations. Like, this is the bread and butter of the union movement. And so it's important if you don't have a culture like that, and many environmental organizations don't have that culture, just to understand that when workers are shouting and talking about how important something is to them, or if they're refusing to engage with you, that this is part of our culture. We're fine with it, right? It's not unusual. It's something that we do in negotiations with employers and governments, and it's something we have had to do in order to win and keep fundamental rights. So that's just very important to have in mind. I want to give a couple of examples. I don't want to use too much of your time, but just to sort of get you thinking a little bit. So in Germany, you may know that the government finally set up a commission, a sort of task force with unions, with government, federal government officials, with regional governments, and with environmental organizations. And this task force, which was popularly called the Coal Commission, but I can't call it that, I must call it by its formal name, was supposed to negotiate a plan to transform Germany's energy sector, including the phase out of coal. And they did agree to that plan. Now, there were a few things about that process which were really important. The single most important thing about it is that the idea for that commission came from the union movement, and they advocated for it for 3 years before they finally got the government to agree to it. They wanted a process where they could negotiate all the things that they needed for workers to get a fair deal in this transition. The second most important thing about that process is that the frontline unions representing coal miners and workers in coal-fired power stations, they showed up for this process and participated for more than 6 months in these negotiations. And everything else about the process, not so important from a union perspective. The main thing was that unions came to the table and they negotiated a massive change in their sector with a bunch of measures to protect workers. So what I noticed along the way, having many friends and comrades in the climate movement, is that people got very upset about things that the mining and energy unions were saying and doing in this process. And I'm like, this is a big thing for their members. They are negotiating really for the lives and future of their members and communities. They're going to say a lot of very harsh things. Some of those things are correct. But they're at the table, and they are negotiating. They're working towards an agreement, and that is what matters. Another thing that a lot of people reacted to from the unions was that this commission went to all of these different areas, especially in eastern Germany, and they visited the communities. And in these, when they would go to areas where you had a lot of coal mining and coal-fired power, they had massive demonstrations of workers who were protesting to keep their jobs and saying, don't destroy our jobs and our communities. So I noticed that a lot of friends, people I know well from the environmental movement, were really upset by this because they were like, workers are demonstrating to kill the climate and to keep putting out polluting emissions, you know, coal pollution. And that's not what they were doing. They were demonstrating to keep their jobs because after the reunification of Germany, there was a massive deindustrialization of East Germany. Many people became unemployed overnight. There was a lot of suffering. And so that is the context For these workers, when they hear someone talk about changing the coal sector, their context is that the same thing is going to happen to us again. We don't want it. You must show us, not tell us, that this is going to be okay. Right? So that here in Norway, again, you may see, and we have seen, mobilization of oil workers who are saying, don't destroy our jobs, don't change the tax system, and so on. And that should be fine. We should understand that that is going to happen, and that that this is a life or death issue for a lot of people, even if we have a strong social protection system here in Norway. Understand that people are, it's not that people don't know about climate change, they don't care about it, it's that they don't yet see a path forward for themselves and their communities, and as long as they don't do that, then they are going to see this as an attack on jobs. The German Commission did reach an agreement, and I just want to point out one other thing that happened after they reached the agreement. The mining and energy unions, who had been super noisy and hard in the negotiations, right? Like, they barely reached an agreement. And by the way, from a worker perspective, it is a good agreement. So it basically guarantees that no worker is going to lose her or his job because of this change in the energy sector. So either they get a bridge to pension or they get a new job of equivalent quality and they get skills training, and this transition is not going to happen on the back of workers. And this, these communities, especially in eastern Germany, they will finally, 30 years after reunification, start to get decent modern infrastructure, investment in education and training institutes, and all the things that might make people want to stay in that part of Germany as opposed to moving. The mining and energy unions immediately went out and had a process with their members, and they met with members at work sites in all of the affected regions to put forward what had been agreed, get their consensus on it, explain to them what it would mean, and what the next steps were. So once they agreed, they really agreed, they went out and socialized the agreement with workers. Now, the other example I want to give is from the United States, where I was born and where I still work a lot with the U.S. unions. So some of you may have heard about the Green New Deal, very exciting development in U.S. climate policy. If not, it's basically a proposal to transform the whole U.S. economy and also to have what in Norway we would think of as a perfectly acceptable social welfare system, which doesn't exist in the U.S. right now. And the perception of the labor movement's response to it is that the labor movement is against all climate action. And having worked a lot with U.S. unions, I can just say that's actually not so. The issue is that for people who are working today in coal mining or coal-fired power or in oil and gas, mostly in refineries, that's where most of the organized workers are, or who are building pipelines, because pipelines have also been a big issue, that those are actually the best quality and best paid jobs around, with health care and pension. And that when other people are talking about the millions of jobs in solar panel installation, it's actually not so relevant, because a solar panel installation job in the U.S. pays maybe a third or a quarter as much as a job building a pipeline, and it generally doesn't have health care and benefits, which are not supplied by the state but by your employer in the U.S., right? So when you're saying to people, well, you don't have to build pipelines, you could install solar panels, they're like, why? that's not, I'm going to lose my health care. Like, what if somebody in my family gets sick? What does that do for me? So the concerns, what it boils down to is that for labor unions in the U.S., for these frontline unions that are involved in fossil fuels, whether it's coal or oil and gas, for them to look at this transition and not be very fearful means that they have to see that there is a job and a future for them that is at least as good as what they have today, if not better. And it has to be concrete. It can't just be someone like any of me or anyone else telling them, no, there are all these jobs in renewable energy. It has to be a collective bargaining agreement with a big offshore wind company that is building offshore wind off the east coast of the United States and is promised, you know, is signed an agreement that it is going to be all union jobs, that they're going to get what's called prevailing wage, which is a decent wage. They will have health care and benefits, and the employer is investing in a skills training center. Then you will see these same unions that today love to build pipelines, they will love to build offshore wind if those jobs are good jobs. And as I say this, I'm seeing my Danish union brother at the back, who we've been working on this project, right, with offshore wind and the U.S. unions, laughing. But that is actually what it's about. So I want to conclude just with one thing, which is that when we're working with unions in the Just Transition Center, and as I said, we're working, you know, in a range of countries, but also with workers in high-emitting sectors, we focus on two things for Just Transition. Will whatever this agreement is, will it bring down emissions or maybe do something massive on adapting to the impacts of climate change? But the second, and even more important, is will it improve the material conditions of workers? Because if you're talking about climate action and there's nothing in there about maintaining and ideally improving the material conditions of workers, then you might as well not be having the conversation. The labor movement is the second largest group of organized people in the world. The first is religious people, second, labor. And if you want a massive shift on climate change, then it's important to have workers with you and not against you. So that's it for now. I'm happy to answer any questions you have later on.
Tusen takk, Samantha. Nå skal vi prøve å få til et innlegg på Skype fra Nederland. Can you hear us, Job?
Hello.
Hello. I'll just introduce you briefly in Norwegian and then pass over. Job van der Assen jobber I Naturvernforbundets søsterorganisasjon Friends of the Earth Nederland, og jobber veldig mye med forskjellige temaer I klima og organisering, og så snakke litt om hvordan de har jobbet med det I Nederland. Job, over to you to talk about climate organizing in Holland. We're looking forward to hearing all about
it. Great. Thanks for introducing me. I didn't get a word you said, but anyway, hi, I'm Job. I work for Friends of the Netherlands. And I was asked to tell a bit today about how Friends of the Earth in the Netherlands has really changed a lot in our working ways in order to work on the just transition, but also to engage more with affected communities, workers, and move away from the traditional way of how many environmental NGOs are working. So maybe to give a bit of the political context, I'm not sure how much in the news it was in Norway, but we had elections 2 days ago, and we see that the Green Party has doubled their seats in the Senate, which is not the parliament, but the second parliament where laws pass through. But also we see that a new far-right environmental or skeptic denial party, xenophobic, those terrible things, has come out of nowhere to become the biggest party of the Netherlands, which is now, they're not running the parliament yet, but this gives a context in which we have to work here in the Netherlands, where on the one hand, we see a lot of young people saying we need climate action. And on the other hand, we see a lot of people, middle-aged, who are fearful about what climate policies, how it will affect them in society, how much it will cost. And that's the context that I think the environmental movement really has to work with. And I think that's partly why we as an organization have really shifted not being a traditional environmental organization in that sense, where we have all these different topics, working on gas, working on food and agriculture, but really building one strategy for the just transition, so that we can really roll that out and get more awareness, but also more kind of that people support the just transition in the Netherlands, and that has become our key indicator as well. So not the policy outcomes on environmental topics, but really, are people willing to support the just transition for workers, but also for the climate? And we explained the just transition as four ways. We say that big companies need to pay their fair share. That's a main part of it. But also that everybody should have access to climate policies. So not just subsidies for the rich who can afford it, but really everybody. And that also that we have a collective responsibility then to make that available, so that we really create a level playing field for everybody to be part of the just transition. And we also say that the just transition doesn't stop at the border, or we need to really take into account the global context in that. And people need to be part of or have a say in the just transition. So that's how we that's our kind of way of saying, or our statement for how the just transition is. In that, changing the organization on kind of on strategy and working on one strategy, we also have started working much more on organizing tactics, which traditionally a lot of the labor unions have worked really with this. We see that it is really effective for the work that we're doing. So a lot of traditional environmental NGOs, anyway, in the Netherlands, they are organizations that people pay into. We have 90,000 members and donors. And we do the campaigning, we do the lobby and advocacy, and so on and so forth. But we have changed a few years ago into more of an organization where we really actively are looking for the power we need to change things. So we are more actively building alliances and working with people and volunteers and giving them the tools that they need to make the impact we together want. And in the organizing work, I think one of the key or a few of the key things that we've really changed anyway is that listening is one of the most important things in building your campaigns, basically. And I'll talk about a bit more about that later. But also, the building new alliances was one of the big things that we have done over the past few years, and we're really working on that, on getting more people involved and building power, basically, and leadership development and the structures that support more people to get engaged, more alliances to get engaged. And I'll go into a few examples that over the last few years we've really worked with. The one big good example was that we, in our food and agriculture work, we realized at some point there was there's this idea that farmers and consumers are two groups that stand against each other. And here in the Netherlands, there's a lot of debate about farmers. They destroy the planet, and the farmers say consumers don't understand us. And we felt that basically the system is standing at the sideline as the laughing third party, and running away with all the money and all the goods. And we felt that we needed to really unite consumers and farmers and really together work with that. But in the farmers communities, Friends of the Earth was really a no-go. A lot of farmers really did not like us. So at some point we started a big project where we trained hundreds of volunteers to just go and listen to farmers. And we did this together with Climate Outreach, that is an English group that does a lot on values, does a lot of work on values and talking to people about climate change and how it affects them and how they think of climate change. And one good example of a project they did was where they went to the workers in Alberta at the tar sands, and asked them, so why are you working for these companies? And for obvious reasons, they said things like job security and other important stuff to stay safe and keep alive. But they also felt that, or a lot of what the people there said was also that they were really proud of being an energy provider for the world, and working tar sands was a very innovative way of working. So they felt that was they are part of that. And if you think through that, if you're a solar panel instructor or installer or working in the wind farming industry, you can also be innovative and also be the energy provider of the world. So a lot there, the environmental movement has changed its narrative also towards those communities, and they see there's much more a common ground and more ideas of working together. So we did this with farmers, the same. We went out and talked to hundreds of farmers across the Netherlands, and we had a conversation. There was no catch. We didn't want them to get engaged, but we just wanted to listen. And we changed our narrative throughout this project in our campaigns a lot more on just pricing for farmers. And so where we combined the social issues for farmers and the environmental issues on food production. And we, through building those alliances, we see that farmers' unions are much more positive towards Friends of the Earth. At some point, there was one of the more progressive farmers' unions who for many years had thought we were the enemy, said in a newspaper that Friends of the Earth was the only environmental organization that you could really talk to and understood them. So that really helped us to work together and for the around the trade agreement TTIP, we work together with a lot of these farmers' unions to try and stop that trade agreement. So that's one example of how we really have built different alliances with farmers and workers, and that we want to really continue doing also with people working for coal power plants, or we're looking at different ways. Also, in perspective of this context of how the political dimension in the Netherlands now is that a lot of people are more climate skeptical. So we need to really do that outreach to society and talk and listen and understand what people's problems are. Another good example of building alliances is together with affected communities. So we have worked a lot together with the people in Groningen, which is a northern county in the Netherlands, where the biggest gas field of Europe is positioned. And we, for climate reasons, really want to shut down that gas field. But there, the people that are living there, they have more and more earthquakes throughout, because of the gas drillings. So we have really, we went to Groningen and we were there and we engaged a lot with the local communities, and together we organized, basically. We got people engaged, and together we shaped a debate around a gas extraction in Groningen, which was won, and the government last year said that they will gradually phase out gas and shut down that biggest gas field in the Netherlands. And of course that brings about more problems with gas coming from Russia, but at least this battle was won, and we now need to carry on that. And the same we did with people who are affected by air pollution. And we have for a long time run a campaign on dirty air, we tried to lobby the government, and that was in a way effective, but it did not have the emotion that it needed to win that campaign. So at some point we started organizing in different cities across the Netherlands, and we worked together with these people to tell their stories, and they did the media work, they did the lobby work, which was much more effective, and a lot of cities across the Netherlands have now put in place a environmental zone for dirty cars and other traffic. Throughout the lobby and the pushback from the people, basically. So that is another good example of how organizing and really changing your work ways, and not only focusing on environmental issues, but also the social issues have really been effective in the aims we had as an organization. And then the last example that I would like to give is a big climate march that we have been organizing 2 weeks ago, just before the elections, where we were negotiating. The Dutch political system is a interesting one where politics says, okay, we'll just put companies and the social middle field around a table, and they'll figure out how we should deal with climate politics or climate policies, but also pension funds or whatever. They always, the politics doesn't decide. They say society should decide, and that system works in many ways. Or yeah, we can debate that, but in this particular case on the climate, we saw that big companies were really blocking more ambitious climate deals, and so there was a climate accord that came out, and the environmental movement was really not happy about that. So mainly because CO2 taxes weren't on the table because companies blocked that, and a load of other things that were much more effective in getting or reaching our climate policies were blocked, basically. So we, as an environmental movement, together with the unions and the renters' rights organizations, we stepped out of those negotiations and we said no further. We do not support this. And that, through that, it gave a tremendous momentum in the Netherlands around this debate. And that momentum we filled with a huge demonstration that we started organizing at the beginning of this year. And that was an alliance of more than 50 organizations in the Netherlands. Also, so the unions joined that, the renters' rights, and a lot of different groups that were really stood under the umbrella of just climate policies, ambitious climate policies. And we literally stood under an umbrella 2 weeks ago because it was pissing rain in Amsterdam and there were 40,000 people. And for a country as the Netherlands, where we don't have very much a demonstrating culture, that was ginormous. And researchers said that if the rain wasn't that bad, because it was really, really bad, we would have had much more people joining that demonstration. So, and that gave also kind of in front of the elections, it gave a ginormous push to standing politicians, and they now have proposed under also a liberal right wing party that we will have tax or a carbon tax for all companies. So that push was really needed and worked. And we now have to see its proposals, and we don't know if it's law yet, and we now need to follow that through. And we're really dedicated to do that together with unions and together with loads of different alliances for the just transition. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Joe. Don't know if you could hear the applause, but there was applause. Thank you very much indeed for that. I'd like to call Christian and Samantha back up to the stage. And if Joe, you can stay on Skype.
Yeah, great.
We'll have questions and comments. Feel free to give the question or comment in Norwegian. I can translate, but if you could say it in English, that would be fantastic. We have Bjørn at the back with a microphone who will come around to those who put their hands up. So is there anyone who wants to start with a question or comment to any of the panelists? Yes, here, Bjørn. Thank you.
Steinar Winther Christensen, Besteforeldrenes Klimaaksjon. Do you prefer me to put forward the question in English?
No, there are some for me, I hvert fall. Hvis spørsmålet er til meg.
Du kan gjerne stille på norsk, og så kan jeg oversette det til jobb,
okay,
hvis det relevant.
There is a Dutchman as well,
yes, true,
among us. Well, i Besteforeldrenes klimaaksjon så har vi en diskusjon gående for tiden, hvordan fokus skal være i forhold til å skaffe flere medlemmer til organisasjonen. Vi har i dag 2,500 medlemmer, cirka. Det spørsmålet prøver vi å nærme oss på to måter. Den ene måten vi prøver å få folk med oss på, det å appellere til hver enkelt av oss at vi skal leve mer, skal vi si, klimavennlig. Alle de elementene som inngår i det behøver jeg ikke nevne. Det en approach, for å si det slik. Den andre approachen å si til folk, lev stort sett som før. Fly gjerne litt mindre, men i all hovedsak, lev litt som før. Ikke føl dårlig samvittighet for hvordan du forholder deg i hverdagen. Min tanke at i den grad man gir folk dårlig samvittighet for sitt levesett, eller indirekte prøver å fortelle dem det, så vil folk trekke seg tilbake. De vil da ikke føle at de har, skal vi si, stamina nok til å være med i denne type forening. Mm. Så jeg vil gjerne høre hvordan dere tenker rundt dette. Skal man si til folk flest, lev stort sett som før, du lever ikke feil på noen måte, eller skal hovedfokuset være til folk, dere bør leve annerledes for så å si å fortjene medlemskap i vår forening?
Christian, kan du begynne?
Ja, det kommer jo an på hvor mange medlemmer du vil ha, da. Nei, jeg tror at det å jeg tror at det å privatisere løsningen på klimaspørsmålet i for stor grad, altså gi det ansvaret til enkeltpersoner, og at de har selv ansvaret for å endre sin egen adferd i så stor grad at det kommer til å monne, det er å ha inngangen blir litt feil. Jeg tror at man må jobbe for å endre systemene. Så skal man selv bidra, så klart, til å kjøre mindre, ta i bruk ny teknologi, legge om matvanene sine og sånne ting. Men det viktigste, tror jeg, er at du viser mulige nye medlemmer hvordan de kan være med på å skape en bedre verden. Og at det ikke først og fremst handler om at de skal dusje kortere, ha det kaldere hjemme, gå når det regner, og så videre. Det er ikke der du løser problemet. Der du løser det, er der hvor du klarer å inspirere og bidra til å få folk med på en samfunnsendring. Jeg tror det er det som ville være den riktige inngangen.
Samantha?
Yeah, so Christian has said roughly what I would say, but in a much more sort of smooth way. When we make climate action too much about individual choice, then we're taking on the logic of neoliberalism, just to put it out there. And indeed, it is a systemic issue, especially at this point. That doesn't mean that as a tactic or as a way of mobilizing people, that encouraging them or even demanding that they change their own behavior, you know, change starting with yourself, that that's a bad tactic. It can be a good tactic. It can also be a way to make people clarify their positions. Remember earlier I said something about conflict not always being bad and causing some conflict amongst your members about looking at their own consumption versus the things that they're demanding might not be a bad way to mobilize people a bit more on your cause, right? So I'm just looking at it specifically from a tactical and strategic perspective. The one thing I would say, and just to take this back to the labor movement, is that shaming people for working in fossil fuels, I think that's a bad tactic. And I think that because in this country and in other countries until a decade or so ago, people who worked in oil and gas or in coal were keeping the lights on and providing the world with energy, full stop. And certainly with coal workers, if you look at their life expectancy, even in industrialized countries, a coal miner, his or her life expectancy is, you know, 55, 60 years. And they probably won't be healthy, you know, because you have a lot of black lung disease for the last part of those years. So shaming people for consumption, maybe, but shaming people for taking the good jobs that are available to them and that until relatively recently were seen as very important for society, still important for society, not so good. That's...
Yeah, as someone who comes from a family of Welsh coal miners, I know exactly what you're talking about. You probably got the gist of the question from that answer, but we had a question from the Grandparents Climate campaign in Norway. I don't know if you have a Grandparents Climate campaign in Holland, but they're a key part of the green movement here. And they asked, sort of, how do you get more members? Do you appeal to them on, on an individual basis of how they change their personal behavior? I mean, how does Friends of the Earth Netherlands go about actually recruiting members without giving them a, making them feel bad about their, the way they currently live? We can't hear you, Job. One second.
I was muted. Sorry. We actually did some research on that just recently, where we, a lot of people come into Friends of the Earth and they ask if what they can do in their personal life and if we can do campaigns on that. And we're really hesitant about that because it's really putting them into this neoliberal frame, and we really see that policies and companies need to change in both companies and or policies in companies and in government. But we did a research on this under a broad part of the population, and they feel they can't take action in climate because they're not doing enough in their own life yet. And that was, for me, was recently quite a big revelation of where the ask for what can I do in my personal life is actually the starting point of your political education, basically. So we're trying to really kind of think through this now. How do we do that in a way that we don't start doing consumer, you know, individual consumers campaigns or stuff like that, but more as a means to an end, so a different end, so a starting point for the engagement of people. That might be helpful to think of.
Christian,
angående dette med å gi folk dårlig samvittighet eller forlange at man skal endre adferd. Det som har gjort meg mest forbannet de siste dagene, og det, jeg merker at jeg blir forbannet bare jeg tenker på det, det er den der shaminga av ungdom som skal ut og streike, fordi at de ikke, ja, men de skal jo bli kjørt, de spiser jo kjøtt, de går på McDonald's. At man kommer frem med alt mulig sånn der, ja, men dere gjør jo sånn, dermed så kan dere ikke engasjere dere. Det er jo det, er det største vrøvlet jeg har hørt, og det er den dårligste unnskyldningen jeg hører fra voksne om hvorfor man ikke skal engasjere seg, er det der, ja, men du gjør jo ikke sånn.
Yes, vi hadde et spørsmål her. Om det andre som vil tegne seg, så kan de...
Jeg heter Martin Haustad. Jeg her som privatperson. Jeg representerer ikke noen organisasjon. Jeg har fulgt med særlig på det som har skjedd med ungdommen de siste ukene, og jeg forferdelig glad for det. Jeg har vært engasjert selv i miljøspørsmål i 50 år, og stort sett har det bare gått den gærne veien. Men når jeg ser ungdommen da stille opp i debatten og møte politikerne, så synes jeg at de blir stående litt forsvarsløse, og synes at politikerne slipper veldig lett unna. Og de lider under noe jeg synes er et problem for oss i det hele tatt, og det er at vi har alt for lite konkrete krav. Jeg synes at det er greit å si at ja, vi må redusere klimautslippene, og det eneste svaret vi kommer opp med når det er spørsmål om ja, hva vil dere at det skal gjøre? Jo, vi må redusere oljeaktiviteten, og vel og bra, det må vi gjøre. Men jeg synes at miljøorganisasjonene burde gå sammen og formulere 3 eller 5 eller 10 helt tydelige krav til hva de mener politikerne skal gjøre, sånn at vi kan konfrontere dem med det fra dag til dag. Ja, gjør dere det vi har bedt dere om, eller har dere ikke gjort det? Så jeg kunne tenkt meg noen refleksjoner fra panelet på muligheten for å kunne gjøre dette her, og om dere ser det som nyttig.
Samantha, vil du begynne?
Yeah. It's a good question. So in the labor movement, we have demands, right? So if we mobilize, we go on strike, if we demonstrate, it's because we have demands and we've made demands. Our demands are not being met, and then we increase our action, our industrial actions, until our demands are met. That's the way that works, yeah. And I agree that it's important to have collective demands. And the students' movement is not necessarily about having very clear collective demands yet. I hesitate to say too much about what another group of activists should do or what their demand should be, because I'm not a youth, right? So it's their movement. I am appreciating their right to strike and their activism. I don't want to say anything more about their movement or how they should organize, because I think young people can organize themselves. Like, they don't need my help. Just my support, maybe, or my solidarity. In terms of demands to the government, you know, we do need political demands, we need workers' demands, and we hear about how in the Netherlands, and I know a lot about this actually from Kitty de Jong, our Dutch union leader, who's worked very closely with Friends of the Earth Netherlands, they managed to form common demands between the unions and the first Just Friends of the Earth, and then the rest of the environmental movement about transforming the energy sector in the Netherlands. And that was a painful process sometimes. Yes, I can remember a couple of misunderstandings. But they did it, and they forced a right-wing government to make employers, wealthy employers, pay. Not workers, not taxpayers, but wealthy employers. And we could learn something from that, about learning to have common demands, and those demands would also have to include all the things that you would need for workers in order to get support for a transition like that.
Perhaps we can go straight to you, Job, actually, on this. The question was, today we've had a huge school and university strike with tens of thousands of children around the country in Norway striking for climate change. And the question was about kind of the concrete demands, perhaps, that environmental groups can come together and support. And perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the example Samantha was just talking about. I mean, how did you get together and make those kind of concrete demands? What was the process of organizing towards that?
Personally, on that level, I wasn't that much involved. So, but more on a demands issue, I feel that is very much a thing that is always in kind of more the left wingish parts of society, that we want to kind of first debate on our demands for on end, and we'll look mostly for what our differences are and start discussing about that. And I think one of the successes of neoliberalism is that people got more together, and I think George Lakoff has a really good view on this, an American writer, on values. They came much more together on values, and they started talking about what values do we share, and how do we want to bring them forward. And what happened in that is that people didn't need to necessarily have to have their political, you know, aims aligned, but their values aligned, and they started pushing them really consciously in the US, but also a lot across Europe, to push this idea of neoliberalism back in the 80s, 90s, and still. I think what for me, the big climate demonstration in the Netherlands was a really good example, where we said we want an ambitious and just climate policies, but we invited loads and loads of different groups to come and stand there under that umbrella and to push for their own ideas, and there was really a vast majority of different groups that had never taken on the streets before, because they didn't feel the demands or our demands were their demands. But we had a very global, this is where we want to go for, and loads of people could felt that they could engage with that under that umbrella and push there for their own ideas and what their demands were. And that created this huge, for Dutch standards, huge push towards government. So
I'm not sure. So with the labor union and the environmental movement, I think there was it was more about finding, you know, it was really because Friends of the Earth, of course, is a environmental justice network. So we are very close to the unions. And just by having Kitty and Donald, who's the director, really working closely to each other and looking at what, you know, what do we, what combines us rather than what pushes us away. And that has helped a lot. But we do see that, for example, Greenpeace and other environmental organizations, it was difficult to overcome this, and that needed a lot of talking and seeing that in the end we're working towards a common goal, a common vision, common values, and so on.
Thank you, Christian. Do you want to say?
Jeg tror nok også at man trenger et mangfold av stemmer for å få med seg et flertall av folk, og jeg tror at det viktig at så mange som mulig klarer å identifisere seg inn I en sånn type klimabevegelse, og at så veldig tydelige og få budskap kanskje kan også virke ekskluderende. Så jeg ville være litt forsiktig kanskje med en sånn type strategi. Men nå ikke jeg jo ikke representant for en miljøorganisasjon, jeg jo representant for et forskningsinstitutt. Vi typer kommer jo normalt sett ikke med krav som det. Vi sier mer sånn, ja, hvis vi skal unngå farlige klimaendringer, så må vi halvere utslippene innen, eller kutte utslippene til null innen, og så videre. Og så det opp til miljøorganisasjoner og politikere å på en måte omsette det til politiske budskap, da. Bare sånn at man forstår den arbeidsdelingen mellom forskningen og miljøorganisasjoner.
Har vi flere spørsmål? Ja, her var det en.
Jeg kommer fra miljø- og utviklingsorganisasjonen Spire for unge voksne. Og jeg har ofte sett at vi som ønsker å på en måte ha en fremtid med mindre utslipp og unngå de store klimaendringene, lener oss mye på forskning fra IPPC og på en måte som egentlig ganske sånn ensidig I det å, at vi må gjøre en endring nå. Mens når man skal debattere, så kommer det ofte, virker det ofte som det en balanse mellom at vi har et valg om at vi kan gjøre det og at vi ikke kanskje trenger å gjøre det like mye. Så da lurer jeg på hvordan kan vi kommunisere viktigheten av den systemendringen vi gjerne ønsker, og hvordan kan vi få flere med I den mobiliseringen som vi får nå, som vi har nå?
Ja, veldig godt spørsmål. Christian, vil du begynne?
Ja, jeg tror man rett og slett må begynne med å forsøke å gjøre problemstillingene nære for folk. Det som har vært en stor barriere I å kommunisere rundt klimaendringer at dette har vært noe som oppfattes som kanskje litt hypotetisk og litt langt unna, og kanskje først og fremst har virkning I andre land. Men hvis dere så den saken NRK gjorde, hvor de har reist rundt og dokumentert klimaendringene som skjer her og nå, liksom, og koblet det til folk som bor rundt omkring I Norge, så virket det utrolig sterkt. Og jeg tror det kanskje en mye bedre vei inn for å vekke engasjement enn å snakke om alt det forferdelige som kan skje om en stund. Fordi vi mennesker ikke rigget sånn og skrudd sammen sånn at vi tar det like mye på alvor som det farlige, kanskje mindre farlige, som står rett foran oss akkurat nå. Så jeg, det vil på en måte være mitt korte svar på det.
Svante?
I mean, I think that the last summer here in Norway had an impact on a lot of people who were thinking that climate change was something that would come very slowly to this country and would not affect us very much. But we saw actually that food security was affected here, right? We had massive agricultural failure, basically. Farmers were very affected. And also, if you just look over to Sweden, you could see that we're not prepared for big forest fires as a result of climate change either. That's another thing that can come. So I guess I have to say, I personally have no sense that this is something where we have plenty of time and we can sort it all out later. I wish that were the case. Generally, when we're talking to unions and to workers, we might do a little bit on climate science, but we just also start out with, look, this is happening. We feel and see it around us, all of us, and we know that there's going to be big changes in industry. Workers are already experiencing that. So now we're not debating that. What we need to talk about is how do we relate to this as a group of workers in a company or in a sector or as a labor movement, and what do we want to do? And you can, and we do in this country, have a debate about how long does the oil and gas age last? How quickly does change come? But that change is coming. Like, everybody is clear over that. It's just how fast does it happen? Personally, I am all for different groups of activists having their own roles and strategies. And Spieda, of course, you are, you know, you're youth activists. You're activists for system change, and that's an important role. So I'm not going to try to tell you how to be an activist, but I will say that getting across how quickly change can come, like, that is a really important part also of work within the labor movement.
Kristin, ja,
og så tror jeg man må gi folk en grunn til å engasjere seg. Det var en britisk kampanje som het For the Love of, hvor folk kunne måtte skrive inn sine egne, altså fortelle om hva de var opptatt av, og hvordan klimaendringer truet det. Og i Norge så ser vi det kanskje spesielt, nordmenn veldig opptatt av å kunne fortsette å gå på ski. Så det å på en måte redde, jobbe for å redde de hvite vinterne, redde skiføre og ivareta det, fordi at det noe som folk har nært og som vokst opp med og har liksom veldig sterke emosjonelle bånd til, viser seg å være sånn gode utgangspunkt for å vekke engasjement.
Yeah. Samantha.
Just one very quick thing. I mean, in these last few questions, there's one thing I really want to say. Like, let us not depoliticize this discussion. This is a political discussion. There are politics that will give us a just transition for workers. There are politics and political parties that will not give us that, right? So let us not, when we talk about things that we love and care about, yes, it's important to communicate on values, but it's really important to understand that this is a political fight as well. Politics matter, and politics are not only about elections, although they are also about elections.
Hmm. I'd love to give you a chance to answer that, Joe, but we are running out of time. I want to let one more question come in if we can. There was a question over in this area here, I believe. I think maybe it was you right on the end there. Yes. Very, very quick question with very, very quick answers. Apologies to Job for not allowing you to answer the last question.
Thank you. I have a background in Save the Children and Naturvernförbundet. I'm a member. Looking around the room here, I'm just wondering how it would be possible to include more of our immigrant population in these debates and discussions. It strikes me that it would be a very good pathway to integration. And at the same time, they come from many countries which are going to be far, far more vulnerable than our own to climate change. So I would like to hear.
Yeah, I think we got the gist of that. Job, I'll give you the chance to answer that very quickly first.
Yeah, so that's a really good question, and we're really looking at that as well. How do we work together with different groups as well? So inclusion, diversity, but also migrant groups, different basically struggles. And I think that is the main. I totally agree with this. Is not, you know, we need to talk about values, but it's a political struggle. And in that, I feel that we, as different movements, have also got a bit of the neoliberal thinking of where we say
different struggles are not our struggles, and we they are all our struggles, and we need to really engage with the different struggles. So that's what we are trying to do, really, as Friends of the Earth. So we've joined the Women's March. There's a big march against racism tomorrow, and we want to show that we are part of a broader movement that that together we want to push for a just, fair, environmental world where everybody can live together, and also the migrant communities, we try to engage with them.
Yeah. Christian?
Yeah, veldig godt spørsmål. Veldig vanskelig å svare på, kort på, men jeg tror igjen det handler om å bli relevant også for innvandrergrupper, og henvende seg til dem og snakke om ting som viktige for dem, snakke om ting som skjer i deres hjemland. Altså, kanskje det ikke sånn at Arktis føles så innmari relevant for folk som nettopp har flyttet til Norge. Kanskje heller det vanntilgangen i Punjab som det som tenner en gnist der.
Snaffe?
Well, a quick demand or suggestion to Bruin for Fremtiden for next year, which would be that you have a racial and ethnic equity in your panelists and in your topics. You invite people and you spend the next year having a dialogue with them, with different groups, because there are groups on racial, religious, and other kinds of justice in this city who would have a lot to say. The other thing just to say is that for the labor movement, the fight against the anti-racist struggle, the fight against fascism, and our own struggle for rights, these things are very deeply connected. We will have union leaders from New Zealand here in Oslo next week for a workshop that we're co-hosting with LO Norway, just a small group discussion. And one of the things we're going to talk about is how right-wing terrorism has affected our countries and our movements. Thanks.
Brilliant. I'd like to thank all the panelists for their discussion. If you could give them a round of applause. Thank you very much. Tusen takk til dere også som kom. Ja, det bare å gå ut og bygge Brunn til fremtiden videre, nå at dere så flinke på kommunikasjon og organisering. Vi ses klokken 14 her inne for resten av konferansen. Tusen takk.